us back, and it's mainly in my series. And then there is a bunch of things which we sort of outlined that we should do when we were finishing those papers, and then we still haven't done. And I was basically looking for, you know, when I was asked to give this seminar, I thought that it might be a good idea to sort of stimulate again my interest in those questions. And so there's going to be a lot of results which I'll show, and then there's going to be a lot of statements which I believe to be true, but I have no idea whether they are true or not. And you know, if you'll have any comments about them, just, you know, they will be very welcome. So the first thing which I want to do is just remind to those who were not here during the talk by Christian what he was talking about, and then explain what are the bridges with what I'm going to talk about. So you remember that in, well, most of you know that 1960s, I believe, James created sort of a different interpretation of how do you derive statistical mechanics. And the interpretation was basically that, well, you have an entropy, which is a measure of what you do not know. And the entropy is given by minus P log P, it's the normal standard Boltzmann-Shannon entropy. And then suppose you have a physical system which can live in those states as a continuous system, and it's dx, or discrete systems, and you have finite number of states. And what you know is that the expected value of the energy is given to you. So that the average energy is E. Now, can you find which probability distribution is the one that maximizes the entropy, that is, leaves the most uncertainty in it, given that you know the expectation value of the energy? And this probability distribution turns out to be the standard Boltzmann distribution, which is P is equal to minus B H 1 over Z. Okay. Well.
How is it typically done? I mean, in a continuous system, there's always the issue of binning.
There's always a binning issue about the binning, and so what you actually have to do is you have to do like this, and this is the same problem as you have in Boltzmann paradox, for example, in a mixture of gases. You have to have a discretization, basically action, quantum of action. What is the number of states in the system? And this distribution, this Q, it basically sets the discretization level on discretization on the configuration space of the system. And actually, it's going to be quite important. I'm going to talk about which Qs should we take here. And you'll see, this Q will turn out to be quite important later. But then, so the next thing, this is a standard Boltzmann-Shannon entropy, right? There's a bunch of other entropies. For example, there are Rényi entropies, which are the sum of the integral, doesn't really matter. And the Thalysis entropies, which I prefer not to call them Thalysis because they were introduced about 50 years before Thalys did them, worked with them, but so these are going to be P to the Q minus 1, Q minus 1.
What is the symbol of RQE equals what?
It's log.
Log
of sum of P to the Q, I'm sorry. Yeah. P to the Q. And obviously there is a function just which maps this entropy to this one. It's quite an easy function. The point is that this function is actually a Hamiltonic function. So when one of these entropies is maximized, the other one is also going to be maximized.
Q by Q.
Q into Q. Q into Q. Pardon?
No, it's for each Q.
For both of them, we must have that Q is greater than zero and less than infinity. Actually, it has to be stricter greater than zero. Because for zero Q, you will have the states which have zero probability contributing to the entropy. And that's not good. So it has to be strictly bigger than Q and less than infinity. And then between this and this, there is a function which maps one into the other. And so what you can ask yourself is, suppose I'm going to work with this type of entropy, what is the analog of this Jane's formulation of statistical mechanics? That I'm going to maximize entropy, so, you know, the least known, introduce the least known things into the system, keeping the expectation value of the energy constant. And this turns out to produce your distributions which are of the following form. If we define here, you know, the extended logarithm, or the Q logarithm of an object X as X Q minus 1, Q minus 1, then we can define the function which is and obviously this T of Q is just the same as the Schoenaerts entropy, but instead of the normal logarithm, we just take the extended, the Q logarithm. Then we can define log Q minus 1 of X, and we will call it EQ of X. And this is going to be 1 plus Q minus 1 X 1 Q minus 1. Okay, and then it turns out that the solution to maximizing this entropy, keeping the expectation value of the energy fixed, is what's called our statistical mechanics, non-extensive statistical mechanics, which is basically P is proportional or equal to 1 over Z EQ minus beta H. Okay? That's the solution. And you can see that this is actually a power law function. For Q bigger than 1, it has a power law tail instead of probability distribution, instead of the exponential decay of probability distribution. For Q less than 1, this actually reaches 0 for finite energies, right, for finite axes.
And it goes to Boltzmann for Q equal 1, for Q?
It goes all the way to Q equal 0.
No, but when does it agree with Boltzmann?
For Q equal 1. For Q equal 1, it's a smooth transition on either side. It's actually once differentiable, even, but not twice differentiable.
Thank you.
So basically, instead of the standard exponential probability distribution, we can have a distribution which has a long tail, or a distribution which goes to zero very, very fast, faster than exponential. And No, I think, I don't think so actually, but we can plot this function.
With energy, with Hamilton.
With the energy. And so the question is, are there any systems which satisfy this, which behave as if this is a proper probability distribution to describe them? And there is a bunch of them which people have found so far. So the one which we talked to, which was sort of mentioned during the talk by Christian, is the long-range XY spin system, but the interaction between spins does not fall off with distance. And this system seems to relax to probability distribution, which has a very long tail, a parallel tail, in particular in this form. Other examples which Christian showed were these turbulence examples. My favorite example actually is, but all of these examples are with Q greater than 1. So they have parallel tails. There is another example which may be very, you know, which is my favorite and may be sort of interesting to people in the audience. So if I look at the logistic map at the Feigenbaum point, and what I do is, it's, you know, X between 0 and 1. I'm going to chop it into many small pieces, and then I'm going to evolve the map. And once point gets into here, this is going to increase the count of the times this particular domain, this particular range happened. And what I can do, I can calculate the entropy, right, of words generated by this Feigenbaum, by logistic map at Feigenbaum point. So I'm going to take words x, which consist of xi, xi plus 1, xi plus 2, xi plus n, right, this is just next steps in the evolution of the map, and calculate probability distribution of these words, and the discretized words. Yeah, you have to have a binning, but then eventually you will see that it's not dependent of the binning.
So you fix the binning.
You fix the binning, and you build probability distribution on this, there's k bins over here, and you build probability distribution of therefore k to the nth power of bins, and calculate the entropy of that as a function of n. And what you will see is that this entropy, the ordinary Shannon's entropy. And what you will see is two things, and this is sort of the example which how I will make a transition to the next point of my talk, is that the ordinary Shannon's entropy here behaves as some constant, which I don't quite remember. It's 0.4 something, so it's called alpha, and then log n plus corrections, and these corrections actually do depend on discretization, these are corrections of order 1. But the leading term is logarithmic in n. However, if you try to calculate
for large k,
this would be for large k, obviously. This is a limit for large k, and this seems here in the leading term, in the limit of large k. And there is no linear term in the length of the word. If you go below the, if you go to the point where system is deterministic system, then what happens is obviously this term is absent at all. There is no generation of entropy. You can always predict what the next point is going to be. If you go to the chaotic regime, then there is a linear term in n which emerges in such expansion. Right at the Feigenbaum point, it's logarithmic. What you can do is calculate the Thales's entropy of order q and see how it behaves as well. And you can do it for many q's. And if you happen to do it for s of q equal 0, 2, 4, 4, 5, I believe, some weird number, then this turns out to be exactly proportional to n, so some number n plus corrections, which are also k-dependent. So Thales actually calls this a sub-extensive contribution, so basically entropy here, Cq is less than 1, so the power, the distribution which this obeys to is the distribution which falls off quite fast. I will argue later, and this is actually an example of still the same super extensive sort of example of q greater than 1, however, with the leading term being equal to 0. It just happens so. So just you'll see when I get back to this. Other examples.
N
is the number of observations I'm going to look at. It's not extensive. The first entropy is not extensive, right? And you will see why I think it is important. Basically, I mean, you already see that it doesn't depend on k, this first term. It's sort of a universal term in this system. K is the number of bins. The parameter of the map is fixed at the Feigenbaum point. Right? It's the transition, the critical parameter. And
if it's the Feigenbaum point, 4k equals infinity.
Exactly. So you already see what's happening is that this term is critical. This system is at a critical state, and this term is a universal term. It doesn't depend on the way you actually cut, chop the systems into bins. What you can actually also see that, proof actually, if the bins are not uniform, but rather of different sizes, etc., etc., all the sub-leading terms are going to change. The leading term is still going to remain logarithmic. And so this sort of gives me at least a hint that there may be a connection between the cases where the entropy of the regular system, the regular Boltzmann-Shannon entropy, has logarithmic contributions to it, and the cases where some order q Thales's entropy is extensive. And that's what I'm sort of trying to, I'll give a few more examples here, but I won't actually answer the question, is it really true or not? I still don't know many details. So the examples which Christian also gave us of when the system, when systems obey Thales's statistics instead of the regular Boltzmann statistics is the following case. Suppose I have uh, system in the state I, right? So I'm going to write P of I, and then there is a parameter in the system, which he was describing was the temperature, which is varying itself. But let's just call it X. And we will have that this probability of this state is e to the minus beta of X, and then H I of X, or H of I X. The probability of state I, given some parameter X, is this. So this can be temperature, which is fluctuating. This can be magnetization, which fluctuates across some big sample. Now, having this and having the probability distribution of X's, you can always construct what is P of I. And P of I is P of X given I, P of I given X, P of X, and then summed over all X's or integrated over all X's, right? Depending on whether it's a discrete or continuous variable. Just a state. Suppose it's a discrete state. I mean, I'm freely going between discrete states and continuous states here until some point. So what you can do in this case, you can prove that in such situations, the system is going to satisfy approximately Thales's statistics, at least to the first order in the parameter, which is is the variance of X. So what you can say is, what you can prove, and the, you know, Christian was the one who did this, is that such a system is going to satisfy Thales's distribution with Q equal to 1 plus some number multiplied by the variance of X. Okay. So the smearing of the system introduces parallel tails. Another example.
I didn't understand. You said approximately.
Approximately. To the first order in this guy, then there is correction. There are corrections.
No, that you're just saying Q is one approximately.
Q is 1. So the system starts to be as a Boltzmann-Shannon system, Q is equal to 1, but then when you introduce small fluctuations of this control parameter X around its mean value, then Q changes somewhat.
No, but the validity of some Q, is that dependent on the small variance? I don't care what Q is.
So the Q is going to be... The Q will depend on which variance you have.
Not what I asked. You seem to have said, and I don't know if you meant it, that that for arbitrary variance.
Right.
Can you identify a Q?
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes, I can identify the Q, and then there is going to be a big match between the actual Thales distribution and this distribution which the system satisfies to, until the values of very, very large energies, until very, very large energies. Tails are going to be mismatched. That's why I'm saying it's approximate.
So both the value of
Q is approximate,
and the validity,
and the validity of any Q also depends on X. Right? The other example, which is actually how it's derived in many, like in a few actually statistical mechanics textbooks. So suppose we have a heat bus, and the system which is attached to this heat bus. Normally what we say is that heat bus is huge, so that the specific heat of heat bus is infinite. So our system, the test system, can actually fluctuate in its energy, can give some energy to heat bus, and can take some energy from back from the heat bus, right? Energy has to be conserved. But what if the heat bus is not infinite? So what we can define is the following. We can calculate what is the... basically specific heat of the, or inversion specific heat of the heat bus. So it's how does the temperature of the heat bus change when I enter, when I introduce some of the energy to the heat bus. And if a particular thermodynamical system is attached to this heat bus, then this particular thermodynamical system is going to be exactly in Thales's distribution with Q defined by this number. if this is actually a linear relation. If you can write this derivative as a constant, independent of the energy, independent of temperature, etc., etc., then this constant is going to define to you the Q for which the system attached to this heat bus is going to be in. But that's exactly the same, and that's what I'm actually going to show you, going to sort of hint, is that basically, look, here I'm averaging over axis, right? So it's some control parameter, temperature. The example which Christian was showing, x was the temperature. So temperature fluctuates, and this creates long tails. So basically, look, my test system loses energy. This energy goes back to the heat bus. Heat bus temperature fluctuates. This temperature determines the temperature of my original test system. The temperature therefore fluctuates, and you get deviations from the normal Boltzmann-Shannon behavior. And this is an exact result, basically. And this is also in some PRL paper or whatever. Almeida, I believe. Okay, so basically, it's not all nonsense, right? There are some examples where you would expect that statistical mechanics sort of a la Thales is going to hold. And
can you make precise what it means for this variance to be small compared to what? I mean, is it really just the case that you have a big feedback and a small system, and somehow this has to do with the ratio of the volume or capacity of the system to the heat back? Is that the small parameter? What does it mean?
Basically, yes. Basically, yes. This last thing is exact. If the heat capacity, if the heat capacity is basically linear with the temperature, then this is of the heat bus, then this is an exact result. It may not be linear. And then what you will have to do, we'll have to find out what is the linear approximation to that heat capacity, get the first expanded in the series, get the first order, and then this order is going to give you the approximate Q statistics to which it satisfies to. But it doesn't have to be exactly linear. If it turns out to be linear, then this result is exact, and this result is actually going to be exact, and all of this is going to work.
Right, but there is a physical small parameter, and that has to do with...
And this has to do with the relation, with the differences in the volumes of the test system and the heat bus, basically.
But surely, in the first case, the small parameter is delta T over T.
If you're talking about T, but then, for example, if you're talking about magnetic field, which has its expected value of zero, for example, T cannot have expected value of zero. With magnetic field, it gets to be somewhat more difficult. So basically, there's going to be some parameter which is, as it will turn out, this parameter here. I don't want to go sort of reveal too many things, but suppose that you have more than one of those axes. It's a whole set. Then what we will have here is a trace of the covariance matrix with the coefficients in front. And these coefficients in front are going to be Fisher information matrix, which describes the probability distribution of the system, and you can actually you can prove it. Okay, so this is sort of a big introduction. I'm just showing that there is some relation between one more comment before I move forward. So, what the picture which Christian showed, which some of you do not agree with, some of you may agree with, was a random walker that walks. In the patches of different temperature, right? And so it works like here, and the temperature here is, some one temperature, another temperature, third temperature, fourth temperature, etc. And so what happens in this case is that by averaging over temperatures, we have introduced long range, in this case, long range in the time interactions in the system. If you know that right now you are in the large T phase, large T spot, then you are sort of guaranteed to stay in that spot for a while, and then you are going to move to something else, and so the correlation, temperature correlation as a function of time is just going to fall off. And you can actually calculate how it's going to fall off. It's going to fall off, in this particular case, there have been papers on that, as a power law, which sort of gives you strange, depending on exactly what is going to be the probability distribution of this patches, but in some cases it's going to fall off as a power law, which if a correlation function falls off as a power law, gives us some interesting ideas. And that's precisely what I'm going to try to analyze. So as an example, which I can actually give you a couple of plots later, or I can actually do it.
Same assumption, that we have a local Boltzmann distribution table average.
Yes. Yeah. That's basically the separation of time scales here. And so I just want to give you a few examples. So suppose, and you will immediately see how they are related to what Christian was doing, and then I'm switching to what I am doing. Suppose you have a spin system. It's a one-dimensional spin system, and I can describe it as 0, 1, 1, right, 0, 0, 1, etc., etc. I can try to calculate what are the probability distributions of words of length n in this system. So I just basically take all words of length n, right, get the empirical count of these words, calculate the probability distribution of these words, and from the probability distribution, I can calculate what the entropy is. Let's do the following case, and I mean, we've done these cases. Just numerically, suppose that this is a one-dimensional Ising chain which has a fixed coupling constant, and this is a short-range system. What will be the entropy of such n words? And if you do it, if you basically generate this spin chain of 1 billion words and fit the entropy, then the expansion of entropy in terms of the power series in n in the length of these words is going to be actually very simple. It's going to be m s naught plus s1, where s1 is basically order of one. Okay? That's very easy to understand. Now, suppose I have the following system, and that's where the relation with what Christian was doing comes in. Suppose I have the system, a long system of 1 billion spins, and say after 100,000 spins or so, I reset the coupling constant. So over here, there's 100,000 spins at one particular coupling constant. Then it's another 100,000 spins at another coupling constant, etc., etc. Which, and the coupling constant is taken from some probability distribution, which is exactly the random walker example of Christian. And if you actually play with this and calculate the entropy, you will see that in this case, S of M is M S naught, and S naught is not that much different from this one, somewhat different, but not that much different, plus 1/2 log M plus corrections, which are at most order one. Now let me take
and see.
I can actually write down what this. I can calculate the higher order terms, and we'll get to them. The higher order terms, which are order of one, will depend on the probability distribution we should take, but the subleading behavior does not. This actually depends on what distribution of coupling constants you take. Of course, it must have non-zero variance. Now, it must have non-zero variance, and that I think the variance must not depend on m. So it has to be really a priori specified distribution, and then this term will depend on that distribution. I'll write using the value of this term. This term will not, and then the next correction is also going to depend on this distribution.
Can you sample all the words
on the other? Yeah, I leave 100 millions or so spins to the left and to the right just to make sure that nothing happens. Not that difficult to do. And then I get another chain, a third chain. And so this is the example where we know from what Christian has proven that in this case where we get this logarithmic correction to the normal Boltzmann-Shannon entropy, the system is actually going to be quite well, not exactly, but quite well described by some Salices entropy. So there is some relation here. Basically, we've introduced long-range interactions in the system. And what I'm going to aim at is that this is what characterizes long-range interactions in the system.
But what's the difference between a homogeneous system and one with long-range interactions?
I think you have to ask what the relationship is between n and the size of the region. The size of the region
has to be a lot larger, obviously.
So I think it is really the fluctuation, not the inhomogeneity.
N is at most 30, which I can sample on the computer, 30 or 32, it's a 32-bit computer. And the length of the region is 400,000, and N is 30, and then there's 2,500 of these regions in a billion spins long chain.
But you scan all along
the system. I scan along the whole system. Right, but what this means is that it actually, there are correlations between those N spins across the whole chain. Right, there are some spin, by observing the spins, you can learn what is the J, is the coupling constant which generated them. And that's what...
some kind of equilibrium at a fixed coupling constant. Because it's a very large region, many, many words at that coupling constant. So it's not the same as, and then you go to a very large region where you reach some kind of equilibrium at a different value of the coupling constant.
So
and
interpretation which people who do...
It's not the same.
People who do non-extensive statistical mechanics give, the interpretation is that we are in a non-equilibrium system, that not everything has managed to level out. So there are some fluctuations in the long-range fluctuations in the coupling constants. What I'm going to actually try to show that this is just an example of effective long-range interactions. And there is going to be a really big connection to theory of critical phenomena, which I'm going to hopefully get to at the very, very end. So effectively, what this coupling introduces is long-range interactions. Just like at the critical point, we effectively have long-range interactions in the system.
But if you could just calculate standard correlation functions, which could be inside the region, in the middle region.
Right. It does not. It's going to be short-range. But then when you calculate the correlation, but then when you take correlation functions over all of them, over all of the ranges.
It's just kind of in some kind of trivial, if you have a step function, distribution of J,
and then you average over this, right?
Yeah. Whereas the actual physical correlation is still something.
It actually depends on what do you mean physical correlation, right? It depends on what you average over. So if I average within the block, then the correlation functions falls off very, very fast. If I average over the whole system, correlation function actually doesn't fall off fast. What is the average, what is the range over which you average? Basically, in one case, it falls off with one particular exponent. In the other case, it falls off with another exponent. In the third case, it falls off with a different exponent. And when you average all of these exponents, you get a long power law.
Isn't that because you have this different block?
Exactly, that's fine. I'm not saying it's not a homogeneity. I'm just saying that this introduces a long range.
Because you have a long range order of this block.
Fine.
You have one exponential another, and you end up with a power on the time, except that the J comes from the ordinary system, with the variance.
With some variance, right?
So it can't be exponential, it can't be power law.
Eventually it will have to, but basically only because I do not average over very, very large distances. Numerically, it will.
Not exactly.
And exactly, I can calculate. I mean, if you let me continue, we will actually calculate this. What this is going to be? We can actually calculate what this is going to be.
I'm baffled.
Okay. And
suppose that the distribution of J is not in support.
I mean, you have bounded completely.
Yeah. Then there is some maximum, and some exponential, which is both polynomial. I don't
think
I can get it.
Yeah, fine.
No.
Well, probably.
The two-dimensional Ising model, I think you're creating a critical
point. I think Pierre is actually correct. Basically, what you are saying is that you are introducing scale-independent interactions into the system when you average over many, many blocks. And that's what I'm sort of hoping to get to. But before I go, just one more example. So if I cut this into, again, many, many blocks like this, and then I, instead of having a short-range Ising model in each system, I'm going to have a long-range Ising model, where the coupling constants are going to be, again, taken, say, from normal distribution of whatever, from a distribution of variance of which falls off as I minus J, right, to some power, maybe. Okay. So there is long-range interaction between spins here, and then at this moment, all of the coupling constants are reset, and at this moment all of the coupling constants are again reset, and et cetera, et cetera. And then when you do exactly the same calculations, what you will see is that this is there is a power law correction to the original entropy, and this correction alpha is obviously less than one, and entropy has to be at most extensive, but this is not a logarithm. So basically what happens here is, again, if you get back to this point which I was saying, that by observing the sequence of J's, of spins, you can learn what the coupling constant is. Here, by observing the sequence of J's, you can estimate what are the short-range coupling constants quite well, but then you estimate with less and less precision what are the values of coupling constants at longer and longer distances. And when you add all them up, basically, you get these logs, which add up and give you the power law. And so, while this example, and I'll get to this, how this works out, hopefully. Well, this example is very well, there is an analog of this in Salas's formulation, and basically, Christian has talked about. I don't think that Salas's formulation allows me to create corrections which are power law corrections, and that would be, you know, I would like to be proven wrong if that's the case. So basically what happens here is that instead of just one independent parameter, I have a bunch of independent parameters, but some of them are more important than the others. Create some kind of cascade, and then summation of the logs gives me this contribution, right? Okay, so now I just want to somewhat switch gears and talk about why this actually is important from somewhat different perspective. Suppose we're trying to study critical phenomena, phase transitions. You know, once we know the order parameters, we're in business, right? We can write down Landau-Ginzburg at least and work from there. But what if you don't know the order parameters? So the example of this would be, for example, there was a talk a couple of months ago here on fluctuations in markets. And apparently markets are critical systems, at least on some assumptions, and that are, you know, if you don't look for too long time scales, et cetera, et cetera. However, the standard correlation functions which you may want to write down, which are quadratic correlation functions, turn out to be all zero in markets. So however, the first correlation function which people were able to write down which didn't turn out to be zero was the connected correlation function of if X is the price of the stock, X delta X. Delta X is a jump of the stock from time T to time T plus one, and not like this one, but actually this, correct. This is the first correlation function which is non-zero if you start writing them down and actually measuring them in financial time series. X is the price of the stock, and delta, so x of t plus 1 minus x of t squared c. This is the first correlation function. C is means connected, right? It's the first correlation function which is non-zero, which is appreciably non-zero, above numerical accuracy, et cetera, et cetera. And so basically, markets seem to behave like a critical system, but we have no idea what the other parameters are. We have no idea what to write, and basically what is the Hamiltonian for them, right? So then the question is, what do we really mean by a critical system, sort of a self, a system which doesn't have a scale in it, right? Basically, what we're talking about is if I partition the system into two big parts, left and right, or past and future, and try to actually estimate how much information do I have when observing the past of the system about the future of the system. This number diverges. This number at the critical point. Below critical point, below, say, if it's an Ising spin system, below critical point, everybody is pointing upwards, so the number of bits that you need to encode the right part of the system is just one bit. Are you up or are you down? Right? Above the critical point, well, everybody is pointing the way he wants to point. So again, the number of bits which you need in order to encode how much information does the left part of the system provide about the right part of the system is again an order of few bits. How much is the boundary, what are the values of the boundary spins? That's it. But at the critical point, you have domains, right? And domains are of all different sizes, critical opalescence, whatever, all of these critical effects which we know about. And you need to encode the size of these domains, the position of these domains, and then there are effective long-range interactions between left and the right of the system, which create this dependence of spins on the right of the system on the spins on the left part of the system. So basically, what we're talking about is that at a critical point, the correlation function, information between left and right diverges. When we talk about changes of, say, symmetry between left and the right, what we really mean is that the information that the left gives us about the right is actually changing, it's different. And so we want to investigate what is the information that the left part of the system gives about the right part of the system, and then see how this relates to all of this strange, logarithmic and power law corrections. And actually, can we calculate them or not? And so the first model which we are going to consider is going to be one-dimensional model for a very good reason. And the model is we have past, we have future, we have x's in the past, which are x1 all the way to xn, and then xn plus 1 all the way xn plus m is the future. What is the mutual information between left and the right of the system? Well, mutual information is just imn is just s of m plus s of m minus s m plus n. If the system is ergodic, stationary, etc., etc., if every one of the usual conditions is satisfied. Now suppose that, well, we all know that entropy is not must not grow faster than linearly. So in the limit of the system size going to infinity, entropy has a well-defined entropy density. So this means that I can write entropy of n spins as n as naught plus some corrections, okay, which we'll call S1 of n. Now, these corrections have to be positive. Why? Because basically, once I observe the system, I learn more and more about the rules, about the dynamics that generates the system, and therefore the entropy per word or per symbol Sn of n as n goes to infinity has to go to some constant as zero from above. Okay? So the entropy decreases. This is actually in contrast, so this S of n over n behaves like this. If we're talking about just standard boundary effects, finite size corrections, etc., etc., they can actually go any way you want. They may increase the entropy of the system, may decrease the entropy of the system, so may approach this line from above, from below, doesn't, you know, anything can happen. So what, when I'm talking about system of size n, what I'm actually meaning is the following. In the case of, say, two-dimensional Ising model, there is a big system, infinite system. And then I take n spins somewhere here, and I calculate the entropy of blocks of n within the big system, within the infinite critical systems, and I average over all possible configurations of this n blocks. I'm not taking a size of the system finite. I'm taking a finite subsystem within a big system. And then I'm guaranteed that the approach is going to be from above, and all of the nice things I'm talking about are going to hold. Okay? So now if I assume this kind of expansion, and I plug it in here, and I let m, the future, the length of the future, to infinity, you will immediately see that the visual information between the past and the infinitely long future, which from now on is called I of n, is just equal to S1 of n. So basically, if there is any information between left and the right of the system, past and the future of the system, it means that the entropy is not extensive. And if the entropy has a small correction, then the information between left and right is small. If the entropy has large corrections, information between left and right is large. Okay, what we can do now is try to ask ourselves what this value can be, and what are the examples of different behaviors of this S1 of n. Two examples which are quite easy to identify are, well, obviously, S1 has to be, first of all, less than, before I go, just one point. S1 of n divided by total S of n goes to zero. This is the amount of useful information in the data. This is the amount of total entropy, total information in the data. So what you see is that eventually the fraction of useful information in the data goes to zero, which is sort of a law of diminishing returns. You shouldn't study the problem too long. Otherwise, what you are getting is getting to be smaller and smaller. Anyway, so the examples which we will consider is S1 of n behaving as a log n and a n to some power. And I'll show you when this happens exactly. So the first example is the following. This terminology actually comes from neuroscience or learning or whatever. If I observe a series of data, what I really want to do is I want to learn from the data. I want to predict what the next data points are going to be. Whatever the information in data is that doesn't allow me to make predictions about the next points is the information about the past which is not useful, which is you as an animal cannot use in order to navigate in the world. Right? But between the time you observe something and the time you actually make decisions about it, there is some time delay. So only the information, the data, which is only that information which is about the future is useful for you.
He's not saying S1 is all useful information. He's just saying all useful information is contained in S1. So maybe that's the confusion. He's not saying all of S1 is useful information. He's just saying that.
No, I mean, by saying, I'm saying both. Yeah, you're right. I mean, when you're trying to make predictions from the data, when you're trying to predict what the next data point is going to be, that the maximal possible amount of bits you have is S1 of n. And in this sense, this is useful information. Everything else is just information about the past, which, you know, why do you care, basically? And basically, you can actually prove many things about this S1. This S1 is going to be the generating functional of all possible correlation functions between left and the right, et cetera, et cetera. You can write power series of correlation functions of different orders between things which are to the left of the cut of the boundary and to the right of the boundary, and sum them up, and you will get this S1. So if S1 is zero, all of the correlation functions are necessarily between left and right are necessarily zero. This can be proven.
Okay.
It is called excess entropy as well.
So it is entropy.
Yeah, it's how much interaction do you have across a boundary. It is actually called excess entropy in some literature. We call it predictive information for, because this was analyzed for time series first. Fine. Now, suppose we have the following example. There is the example which we've already discussed. There is a probability distribution of observing X given some parameters alpha. Then there is probability distribution of parameters alpha. Probability distribution of observing X's is P of X given alpha, P of alpha, d alpha, which is the example that Christian was talking about and I was talking about before. You can write down what is the entropy of this P of X going to be. I will have to skip the derivation because I'm going a lot slower than I thought I would. But basically, you can derive this, what the result of this entropy is going to be, in two different ways. Either you can notice, so what I'm going to do is dnx p of x log p of all of x's, right? And there are n x's. This is p log p. You can write this as dn p to the n at n going to 1. This is p log p. Okay? And this, basically this is replica trick. And then you will write a bunch of usual replica transformations, and you will see that the replica symmetric point here is always stable. There is no way you can introduce replica symmetry breaking here in the system. And the point of this is the following. Why this is happening is the following. As you've noticed, we have probability distribution of alphas. So there is a priori number of possible solutions, number of possible models, total number of states, if we're talking about density of states in physics, is 1. So we can introduce the number of the density of states in this model as the number of probability of other solutions, right, which are this is a standard KL divergence, which is a measure of distance between two probability distributions. It's some information theoretic measure. I don't want to write it down, etc. But so what we will do this way is we are measuring how many probability distributions are on the surface epsilon far away from a given probability distribution, as defined by the measure. And this is the density of states. How many possible solutions are there in the vicinity of a given solution at the epsilon sphere around a given solution? And you see that this is normalized. This is equal to 1, independent of the total integral of this d over all possible energies of all possible distances from the distribution, from the starting distribution, is 1. This is very different from what you have in, for example, in physical systems, where in physical systems the standard picture of the density of states, let's say in n dimensions, is density of states is proportional to e to some power. Right? It goes like this. And basically it doesn't have a cutoff until you introduce the size of the system. Once you've introduced the size of the system, there is a cutoff which is some function of n of the size of the system. And you are not, and when you are searching for the best possible match for your solution, when you're searching for a solution, for a set of solutions which minimize your Hamiltonian, right, you're not guaranteed that somewhere very, very far away there is not going to be another solution which is going to be somewhat better than what you already have near this replica symmetric point. And the measure at those points far, far away is huge. So if there is that solution, you're necessarily going to find it and you're going to drop into that into those solutions. In our case, density of states is always like this. And once you've analyzed and figured out that the replica symmetric solution is stable, you are guaranteed that even if there is another solution somewhere very, very far away, which is also stable and lower than the replica symmetric solution, the measure of that solution is negligible just because the original density of states at that level is zero. Okay, so basically what it means is that the replica symmetric solution here is stable, is a true solution, which also means that the Kronstein and Anild approximation to this system are exactly the same, and you notice that this axis over which I'm averaging over, this is a Kronstein noise, right? So what happens is that you can calculate as many things as you wish for this system. And as it turns out, this system has a very interesting, this expansion of entropy is the following. S is equal to n S naught, but I don't care much for the value of S naught, but we can calculate it, plus k over 2 log n plus entropy of alphas plus 1 half trace log of Fisher information matrix of this probability distribution with respect to alphas plus something which is of order of 1 over square root of n. Okay? Now, if you take different distributions of alpha, the only stuff which you're going to change is this, this, and this. Sorry. K is a number of parameters. It's the dimensionality of the vector alpha. And therefore, I mean, the example which Christian gave, you know, or the plot which I showed there, will always have 1 over 2, every ratio of 1 parameter. These things are going to change depending on the distribution of alphas. This will, but this will not. This is a special term, right, in some sense. Why is it k over 2 log n? That's actually quite simple to understand. I mean, you all know in statistical in statistics, when you try to estimate a parameter, the variance of the parameter goes as 1 over square root of n. So when I do this integrals by subtle point approximation, right, there's going to be a dominant value, and then the variance around it as 1 over square root of n. If there are n parameters, k parameters like that, the determinant is going to give you k over 2 log n. And that's what this k over 2 log n here. Okay, so this is an exact calculation for the system that Christian, for example, was talking about. So basically what we are saying is that there is some kind of universality. Even many systems with different Qs still produce the same corrections to the extensive entropy of a system. Now, there is also a model where you can get not these logarithmic corrections, but actually power law corrections. This is quite a simple model, which is due to Cullen, Delic, and Strong. A couple of years back. So suppose I say that instead of distribution P of X given alpha over which I'm averaging, or which I was averaging, I'm going to go to a continuous distribution Q of X, which is unknown, and there is a prior on this distribution Q of X, which is given by our usual standard kinetic energy term. Okay, so this is a prior on distributions Q, and phi is log Q, minus log Q. So we're saying that the log of the probability distribution has to be continuous, basically. Distribution has to be normalized. And so in this case, basically, you can rewrite this probability distribution. There is no alpha. It's phi. Q of X, the whole distribution, right? It's now an unknown function. So I'm going to learn a function from the data. So when I'm going to average over alphas, instead I'm going to average over all possible functions weighted by this particular measure. That's a standard, basically, it's a one-dimensional field theory instead of just calculating Gaussian functional integral over all of them. Instead of doing a functional integral, what you can do, you can rewrite Q of X as sum over mu, alpha mu is a cosine or sine mu pi X, just Fourier expansion, if X is between 0 and 1. Then what you will see is that this prior is actually equivalent to all of the modes alpha mu plus minus, right? Cosine sine modes, decoupling from each other, and they a priori have a priori alpha mu plus minus. is taken from a Gaussian probability distribution around zero with a variance which goes as 1 over mu with some constants there. So basically what we have is, this is still a finite, this is now an infinite parameter system, right? The cardinality of alphas is infinite. However, the variance of each next mode, each next parameter is falling off a priori. And so if I run this system, for example, if I calculate what is going to be the predictive information of this correction to the entropy, then this correction to the entropy turns out to be S1 of n is proportional to n to the 1/2. And very similarly, we can create different probability distributions which will produce different exponents here. But the point is that, so now I have a cascade of unknown parameters which I'm trying to learn, some of them more important than the others, and I get this. By the way, if you actually try and go take a long set of books and try to calculate what is the entropy of n words taken from this, n sequence, n letters, n consecutive letters taken from this big book, you will see that it's about this. So the human language has a random component S0, which is actually very, very small. It's about 1.2 bit per symbol. So it's very, very small. And then there is a huge subextensive power law correction to this entropy with exponent of about 1/2, which is sort of meaningful because there are rules, right? Rules which say that there is that you must have consonants after vowels, and there are rules that a noun has to follow a verb or vice versa, and then there are rules that you have to put commas somewhere, etc., etc. Rules go at many different scales. When some of them are important everywhere, some of them are only important when you look at the whole sentences. When you sum them up, you will get some kind of power law correction. The fact that it's 1/2 is probably pure coincidence.
Have people compared languages?
Yes, it's actually the same, and you can actually prove that this is the same.
The power. But there must be...
The other things are not the same. And the way you prove it, so...
You can figure out that
this is what determines richness, actually. So but they're all the same, and you can prove that they're all the same. If you can translate from one language to the other, then this number has to be the same. And this is basically, so the point which you asked is, which Q do I use to normalize the entropies? So what we've decided to do is, there's this whole big discussion in the literature determining what is the complexity of a physical system, complexity of dynamics, et cetera, et cetera. Kolmogorov complexity, which is basically description complexity, how many bits do you need in order to encode the dynamics, encode the whole time series. If I start defining complexity using axioms, right? I can say that complexity of two things together is twice the complexity of one thing, that if one thing is a conditional, consists of if there is conditional dependence that if one happened, two must happen, and three must happen, then the complexities of them add just like they add for entropies, etc., etc., then you can create quite a few axioms like that which are meaningful and will define what the complexity of a time series is for you. And so the crucial axiom which we decided to take is the following, that complexity must not depend on local invertible time transformations, which is basically to say that if I define entropy with that normalization Q at the bottom, and Q is constructed of invertible time local operators, then whatever the complexity is, it must not depend on those Qs. And this is meaningful because basically, look, if you look at New York Times front page and there is a small misprint, all P's are replaced by U's, for example, you will still be able to reconstruct what the article told, right? It's still the same article. You can create the backward transformation and get the same article back. English and Russian, for example, if you're translating from one language to the other, they are basically translatable one into the other, right? If you only allow transformations of a short scale, it doesn't change the meaning of the article. It doesn't change the meaning of the book. It's still Shakespeare's book in English, or it is a Shakespeare's book in Russian. computer science, this would correspond to the fact that in Kolmogorov complexity definition, you always have this huge compiler-dependent constant correction to the definition of complexity. Complexity is only defined up to a constant. And so that's precisely what we're doing here. We're saying that all of these constants, however big they are independent because they may change depending on which particular computer you take. So, fine. Now, I just...
So you want to construct a scalar and something that doesn't depend on the way you bend or the way you...
I want to construct the parts of the entropy which are independent on how you bend or how you permit, for example. Yes, right. And so, for example, what you can... what and that's what I want to define as complexity. And that's our definition, right? Whatever. So that's our definition. I think it's meaningful and it agrees with many other definitions people have done, but people have done it in many different contexts. In this way, we can actually create it for many contexts. And the point is basically, look, if I'm observing a velocity flow with some speedometer, and the speedometer acts as a filter, it kills off higher frequencies, basically, time delay somewhere, et cetera, et cetera. I don't want the definition of complexity flow to depend very much on how good my speedometer is, right? Whether the time constant of speedometer is 5 or 7. At least when I'm looking at the large scale properties of the flow and when I'm defining complexity, it's always the large scale things which are important. Looking at this part of the system, can I say something about the other part of the system? So when I'm looking at large-scale things, I don't want my small-scale objects to matter. And that's why we've chosen this definition, and it seems to work so far. So now, what is the connection of this to the theory of critical phenomena, for example? Just a bunch of examples which I will throw, and then I will end with this. So if you look, so basically I'm saying that the correct definition has to be such that it is not dependent on which particular normalization you take as long as the normalization consists of time local operators. So basically if your Q there is anything that you can write as, for example, like this, right? It's a local Hamiltonian, right? Then this is a proper, whatever definition you make has to be independent of which Q you do. And normally what people would say is that definitions which we take have to be independent of Q, and Q is just basically Q of X. The only operators it can depend on is the value at the point. Which is not the only possible local operators. You can take derivative as well, et cetera, et cetera. And the point is that all of these operators are going to change corrections, but they are not going to change these things, and this is provable. So the logarithms or the power laws are not going to depend on those local operators. So these things are universal, and that's why it makes sense to try to talk about them in the sense of how we talk about critical exponents in critical theories. And the hope is, and that's what we are trying to analyze, that's what I will, what I'm thinking about, is what is the relation between the scaling fields in the theory of critical phenomena and the coefficients in front of those logarithmic terms or this particular term. And the examples of this actually, why there has to be a connection is actually a very simple thing. So I'm going to, as I said, throw a bunch of examples and end with that. Okay, so if I look at a polymer which lives on a big lattice, how many different possible random walks of non-intersecting random walks are there? And you know the following, that the number of such random walks is equal to n to the gamma and then some s to the n. Whereas this S is going to depend on the particular lattice, right? Gamma is not going to depend on the lattice. Gamma depends only on the dimension. If I take the logarithm of the number of possible random walks, which will give me the entropy of possible polymers of length n, the entropy is going to be, let's call it S naught, n S naught plus gamma log n. And just as we had before, this term is independent of particular lattice. This logarithmic correction is independent of the particular lattice, while this and this are dependent. Now, if I look, for example, at a polymer which is not a free-flowing polymer, but a polymer which is attached to a wall and is allowed to go only on one side of the wall, right? The number of such possible random walks, this is actually an example of why that I'm actually, the number of such possible random walks is again m to the gamma s not n, but now gamma is negative.
It's a
gamma, yeah, it's a different term. But now it's negative, which if I write it down this way, will tell me that entropy is approached from below, which means that something is wrong. And so what's happening here is that I've made a mistake, and the mistake is the following, that I'm trying to estimate entropy of the whole big blob of length n. Instead of taking a sequence within block, within the infinite polymer of length, a sequence of length n within the infinite polymer, and trying to estimate entropy of that sequence. If I do that, I will again recover that n is equal to yet another gamma double prime s0 of n, where gamma double prime is going to be again positive.
The one with the gamma
actually,
prime, yeah. Correct.
It's correct, but what I'm saying is that now, while in this case, in the first case, I'm actually learning something about the dynamics, so I get more and more ends, and I think, and at some point I realize, aha, the polymers must not cross. There is a rule which prevents them from crossing. What happens here is that as the sequence increases bigger and bigger, my center of the polymer moves farther and farther away from this point where it was hooked, and then eventually, very far, when n is infinitely large, I forget that there was a wall. When my polymer is so far away from the wall, I forget that there was a wall. So instead of actually learning things, I'm forgetting things, and that's why gamma prime is negative. But if I actually calculate the entropy of polymer inside this block, I will get this gamma prime, gamma double prime, it's going to be positive and actually going to be the same as gamma, as the original gamma. And this is why I needed to you received my mailing yesterday about Dijin's book. I wanted to look up the values of those gammas. Okay, this is one case. Now, another situation. So, critical phenomena, two-dimensional Ising, big blob of Ising spins extending to infinity. What I've told you that I need to calculate entropy of n spins within a block, within infinite size block. And I have to average it over all possible realizations of the spins. If the system is ergodic, I'm finishing up in 2 minutes. If the system is ergodic, it means that I do not have to actually average over time. I can just take different blocks of size n, here, here, some other here, and calculate what is the entropy of the same size block n, just positioned at different points in my system. If I'm a critical point system, it's still ergodic, so it's fine. But now look, what this happened? What are these blocks of length n is? The Sakadanov's block spins, right? Instead of observing an entropy of a single spin, I am now observing the interactions between what is the entropy of a spin or of an object which consists of n large spins, which is thinning out block spin transformation. So if the entropy is going to have a correction to it, correction to the standard linear, this correction is going to be determined by those scaling fields which are relevant. How precisely, I do not know. I mean, I have to figure this out. And the logarithmic correction is going to be basically a result of the RG transformation. So taking n large doesn't actually mean that I'm increasing the size of the system. Taking n large means that I'm running an RG flow to larger and larger scales. That's what this n is. It's not the finite size effects. This is the RG transformation. And so this 1 over whatever alpha log n thing is going to depend on scaling fields, and I need to calculate what those are. And the final example, so suppose you have an infinite number of relevant scaling fields. This is a terrible thing, you know, we don't want to think even about these things, right? But what happens if the exponents, scaling exponents of those fields are such that, for example, for the first one it's 1, for the second it's 1/2, then 1/3, they're still positive, but then, you know, falling off further and further and further. I don't know whether there are systems like that, but if a system like that existed, I'm pretty sure that it will amount to an example where the amount of predictive information between two parts of the system has a power law correction. You're just summing up over many possible scaling fields with different weights. Some of them are, all of them are important, all of them are relevant, but some of them are more relevant than the others. And they will be sensed first in this RG, flow, and then you will get a power law. And so basically, the point of all of this is that what I want to say is that, you know, starting from the first, conclusion from the first part of the talk, that when you're talking about Thales' statistical mechanics, I think that this is actually happening, and this will happen in the cases where there is some criticality in the system. If the system possesses some kind of criticality, you will have this power law tails in the probability distributions. So this is the first point. I don't know precisely what the value of Q is going to be, but I don't think that this is actually universal Q. What is universal is that you will have logarithmic correction to a regular entropy. But then instead of logarithmic corrections, in some cases you may have power law corrections, and this is even more interesting than the logarithmic corrections. There is connections between all of this and the theory of critical phenomena. And I would be very interested in hearing, you know, people in the room are more educated than I am, are there actually critical phenomena where you have infinite number of scaling fields with, you know, some of them are more relevant than the others? Do you know of such things or not? And that would be a really interesting point, because I believe that with this approach you can actually try to calculate what are the order parameters. Because in reality, the order parameter is the amount of information you have between left and right. And then its sufficient statistics is the magnetization or something like that. And you may want to just basically to run some statistical analysis on this information between left and right and try to extract the sufficient statistics from that, and this would be the order parameter. So that's...